You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Coming to you live from Studio One in London, this is Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, if diplomacy is like dating, it seems that after Davos, the US and France are going steady.
No, I like him. He's a friend of mine, Emmanuel. he's a great guy. His wife is fantastic. I like him a lot. You know, we had dinner at the top of the Eiffel Tower.
But is the friendship really one for the ages? My guests, Florence Biedermann and Jonathan Fenby, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the surprisingly complex question of how to relocate Britain's parliament while Westminster gets an overdue makeover. And
only people who sleep don't take risks. I myself, there are few people on the earth who has made so many mistakes as I have done.
The complicated legacy of the man who made IKEA. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are Florence Biedermann, the AFP London Bureau Chief, and Jonathan Fenby, former editor of the South China Morning Post, and now chairman of China Research and the director of European Political Research at T.S. Lombard. Welcome both to the programme. Now, in what was the first ever English address from the Élysée Paris back in June, the newly elected Emmanuel Macron took aim at Donald Trump for pulling out of the Paris climate deal. After calling on disgruntled American scientists and entrepreneurs to bring their talents to France, he finished by encouraging viewers to make our planet great again. Now, months later, Mr. Macron is singing a very different tune as he moves to secure France's diplomatic interests. And if you want to know what the relationship is between the two men, you may have heard in the menu, but it's so delicious, we thought we'd play it to you one more time. This is Donald Trump on their special relationship.
No, I like him. He's a friend of mine, Emmanuel. he's a great guy. His wife is fantastic. I like him a lot. You know, we had dinner at the top of the Eiffel Tower.
Emmanuel, Florence, he's absolutely charmed by your president. He seems to have fallen for him. He got a bit of a man crush on him, as one commentator said today. Why do you think that this, you know, this relationship has formed? It's an affectionate relationship when Macron has been quite tough on him.
Why? But because our president is charming, and he's charming everybody. I mean, he's trying to. I mean, he's this capacity. I mean, let's say this intelligence to understand who is his partner. And I think he got something on Donald Trump, which, by the way, is described in this Michael Wolff book, Fire and Fury, like saying like he also wants to be loved like everybody else. So he's playing on this side of him, on this, let's say, human and psychological side of him to make a friend of him. So what would be the result? I mean, yes, friend. I mean, to me, it's a first, like a French president demonstrating friendship and presenting himself as a friend of an American president. It's a kind of a rarity in France. So what would be the result? Obviously, yes, a warming of relation, whether Emmanuel Macron can convince his friend Donald that he has to change his stand on global warming and COP21 or on the Iran nuclear agreement is not proved yet. But it can be only, let's say, beneficial and it can maybe bring some compromise or also like some access of the French to the American market. I don't know yet.
It's interesting, Jonathan, because here in the UK, we can't help but filter all of these stories through a very different kind of funnel, as it were. Because here we have the Labour Party saying that they don't want Donald Trump to come and visit. We have Theresa May, who, you know, she was the first leader to rush and go and meet him, and it doesn't seem to have gelled into any relationship. Do you think that we have done something wrong in not courting him more? Do you think that the French have been clever in the way that they have played their hand?
I think Macron has been cleverer, more skillful, if you like, more perhaps using the French diplomatic charm, which is there. But what he's done, it's interesting, Macron, in the interview, the French television interview he gave over the new year, he was very evidently setting himself in opposition to Trump on things like climate change, globalization, and so on and so on. But at the same time saying, well, I can disagree with this guy in the White House, but I can still talk to him and get on with him. And Macron manages, he's doing this in a number of areas, to set out positions of his own, which may be opposed to those of the leaders of other countries, but say we can still get on, we can still talk, and so on and so on. And in the course of that, as we were saying, he does seem to have genuinely charmed Trump, although it must be said at the end of the Bastille Day parade, which Trump, of course, was invited to, and Trump loved it all, but then the Republican Guard started doing a Def Jam number and boogieing all over in front of Trump, and Macron was clapping away and enjoying himself, and Trump looked completely lost. He thought, what the heck is going on here?
When you look at the example of the UK, do you think that Theresa May needs to learn something from how Macron has played the game? Because the other interesting thing for the UK is this is meant to be a special relationship we have with Donald, and it certainly seems that the special relationship at the moment is a little bit stronger between Paris and Washington.
Yeah, it seems to be worrying people here that Brexit coming and the relation with the special partner is a bit sore. So France has a very different attitude to the United States. We never said, we never pretended we had this special relationship. We don't pretend to have this closeness. So maybe it's easier, you know, to be a little more like skillful or cynical and to have some distance in the game than for Theresa May, for example.
And why do you think there wasn't, you know, what many people think will happen here, that many stories today saying that when Donald Trump comes here, they expect there to be the largest public demonstration seen for years. You know, over 1 million people will come to the streets to oppose his presence in the capital. But that kind of outburst didn't happen in France. You know, French people are as used, if not more used to the British taking to the streets when there's something happening they don't like. Why did it not cause any real public consternation, his presence in Paris?
Because I think we don't have, the French don't have the same kind of relationship, of passionate relationship with the United States, or they have a more distant relationship. Like, look at the war in Iraq, for example, which was one of those moments when French Gallic spirit of resistance to the decision of the United States played a big role. It's in our recent history that sometimes we oppose, whereas here, this closeness, maybe you criticize more your friends than you're not that close friends. So there is a disappointment in Trump, which is less felt in France because there is not this closeness and this human closeness to the country.
Jonathan, Macron, we've watched over recent weeks extraordinary, clever acts of, you know, showing his largesse, his affection, his interest. You know, giving a horse to Xi Jinping, his ability to connect with people, and not dismissing it. You know, here's, you know, a handsome guy who looks dashing, a powerful, clever wife by his side, an impressive. Whenever they turn up, they are they're not quite the Kennedys, but they're not far off it. Now, in Trump's world, you can see how that might play in a more interesting way than the home county's niceness of a Theresa May. And do you think that, again, we can't copy him, but that we are missing something sometimes on the world stage, this understanding that actually you do have to put on display?
Yes, I mean, it's also down to the personalities. I mean, Macron is an exceptional figure, quite clearly, and plays the role brilliantly, both as a star, but also a star with a lot of depth to him. I mean, he knows what he's talking about, and he knows what he's doing. And I'm afraid to say, in this country, in Britain, we just haven't got that kind of calibre of leader or of person. You know, when you think of the possibilities, it's not there. And it's not surprising surprising that somebody like Trump, who is acting in a kind of televisual star system the whole time, goes for the dashing Frenchman rather than for, as you say, you know, Mrs. Maidenhead, which is not, you know, she doesn't cut it in those terms. What is interesting, I think, is that, to go back to what I was saying earlier on, is that Macron seems to know how to play these kind of relationships very well, using his charm, using his dash, using his youth, using everything else there, but in the end not giving away anything as far as one can see, and so on, and setting up the relationship with Xi Jinping in Europe, where he'll be pushing his particular ideas for the Eurozone, given Merkel's relative weakening of position there, and with Trump. And, you know, one just wonders with Macron, how long can this go on for? Because it's almost too good to be true, as they used to say in the old joke about Tony Blair. It's obvious he doesn't know how to swim because he's walking on water.
We're going to move on, but just a last note on that. It's funny because I think we're quite good at doing like the grand banquet or the coming for a pint with the Prime Minister in a pub for a photo op. But this notion of going for dinner at the top of the Eiffel Tower, it turns out that that's kind of what everyone wants to do when they rock up in Paris.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just to go back to something we were talking about before, I mean, you spoke about, you know, the special relationship. That is something which is felt and believed in far more on this side of the Atlantic than on the other. And if you go back, you know, to 1945 and so on, I mean, already then the Truman administration had considerable doubts about that, the specialness of the relationship with the UK. And I think it's something we delude ourselves about in this country. And of course, the whole Brexit process makes, as it were, our belief in our remaining imperial greatness and special relationships all the more fragile.
Well, staying in Paris now, after riding into office on the promise of giving the nation a business-friendly makeover, it seems that Emmanuel Macron's efforts might already be paying off, as Florence has already hinted, because Facebook is expanding its investment in artificial intelligence in the country. Google is going to open 4 new hubs employing 1,000 people in France, and Toyota will spend €300 million to expand its plant. Those are just some of the recent announcements. Florence, are you surprised at this rush of global confidence in France? Because traditionally, France has been seen as somewhere is complicated for international business. One, because you need to do business in French, and many of these international players wanted to do their business in English. And two, the labour laws were seen as unfriendly to outside companies who had their own cultures, for example. Are you surprised that it has taken off so quickly?
Well, first of all, the economic conditions are not bad. I mean, I won't put it all on Emmanuel Macron's charm and magic touch, because in the end, like, he's not the only element. But and second, yes, I mean, he still changed the law, changed the labor law, made it easier for employers to fire people, made it more flexible. He gave some tax break on capital when it was invested. Like, he is creating this business-friendly atmosphere. And this is what he said even before he was elected. So he's doing what he said he would do. And he has also this confidence. We spoke about this self-confidence. You know, I'm young, I'm bright, I was a banker, I know about economics. And as you know, there is also this psychological part in economy. So if you trust yourself, if you show yourself as self-confident, if you are also fulfilling some of your promise, like to improve the business atmosphere, yes, it works. I mean, but again, it's also because the effects of the 2008 crisis are fading now. It's because the Eurozone goes a little better. So there is a whole set of conditions around which makes it possible for him. So no, it's not that surprising. No.
And Jonathan, for you, do you think that also part of this is, you know, that these companies are thinking we need more bases on mainland Europe, not in the UK, so we're not the default answer anymore?
There is an element of that in it too, but I think more important is generally the strengthening of the Eurozone economies, which we've seen with Germany leading the way, but France and Spain also doing extremely well. Again, to go back to Macron's New Year interview, one of the interesting things in that was he was saying all the time, yes, we've made a start, but we're not going to see the effects of this, particularly on unemployment, and particularly on youth unemployment, for another 3 years. So, you know, he's seeing this quite rightly, quite realistically, in a long-term context. And while we've had announcements of job cuts by some of the car firms, other companies coming in and setting up, as you mentioned, the other side of the Macron project, which is to increase training, apprenticeship, and basically raise the skills of unemployed young would-be workers, that hasn't really kicked in yet, and that is going to take time, and that there is this delay between the two. Macron is politically enormously helped by the complete fragmentation and weakness of the opposition in France, so he isn't actually really facing any political challenge there, and the Republican Party, which is divided itself, can hardly oppose what he's doing, since it wanted to go even further. The left, the socialists, are divided. Mélenchon and, if you like, the far left are out on a limb. The National Front seems to have lost its way, if it ever had a way, that is. And he's operating really virtually on his own in a vacuum here with, I would say, and I've been in France a lot over the last year, a kind of general consensus that, yes, it's time for a change.
Florence, what would be your verdict? We're giving him, you know, what's interesting is you often have these players who, you know, on a global stage, their credit is very high. Even for Sarkozy, he was often popular overseas, whereas at home, it was a disaster. It was like the same for Tony Blair. You know, at home, he was losing support, whereas on the international stage, you know, his allure maintained. Here we have a man who seems to be pretty popular at home and overseas. But French people, when you speak to your colleagues and your family and the people you know in your world, are people feeling that this is a man who is extraordinary, or that he has had, as Jonathan says, a bit of luck on his side?
I think he had both. Well, it depends on with who you talk. But let's say generally it's felt like there is a change of atmosphere. As Jonathan said, like, yes, people were ready to change. Yes, people were fed up with right, left, Sarkozy, Hollande. So they were ready for this. And definitely the atmosphere has changed. Not for everybody, not for the people who are still unemployed. Okay, his popularity, I mean, it's interesting because it started very low and then it went up and now it goes a bit down. So if you follow day after day, I mean, it will change, it will fluctuate. But still, I think he didn't have that kind of, you know, hole or sudden severe drop in popularity, because more or less people know and knew what to expect from him. So it's not that they are surprised by what he's doing, you know. So, yes, I would say that I cannot say whether he would be successful or not. What is success? But what you can feel, and that's interesting, like, because I met one of his close aides who came to visit to London. Now they are talking about what they will be doing in 5-10 years. Like, they are projecting themselves, not officially, of course, and Macron would never say that, but they say, this is happening now, this is happening now in France. This is the country where things move, of course, compared with Germany or England. They are moving toward a direction which other countries have already reached. But still, like, this is where things move, and look at this country in the 5-10 coming years. So to me, that's really interesting, because I think they are convinced they will be successful. And yes, internally there are no real opposition. Externally, I mean, economy is picking up and there is this kind of aura abroad. So everything is fine for him so far. And I don't see any big reason for him really to fail completely now.
Just tying, because I promise we shouldn't make this an all France show, but the other, maybe Jonathan, you can pick this up. What strikes me as an outsider looking in, what you don't quite understand is, here's a man who created a party only like 18 months ago, and then he surrounded himself with a group of MPs, many of whom have never held public office, and it's a success. What's the trick there? Because, you know, we in this country, you can't form a new party, it seems. And in most nations, it's very difficult to do what he's done.
Well, I think the word you used previously is that he had an enormous amount of luck, it must be said, with the way the Republicans divided, the Socialists divided. In the second round of the presidential election, he faced Le Pen, and Le Pen was never going to get more than 35% of the vote, whoever stood against her. So he was assured of getting in. And he's known how to play that very well. The danger, in a sense, may be for him that it does all depend too much on one man, Emmanuel Macron, however we pronounce it, and so on. And, you know, the role of the Prime Minister has been diminished steadily under the Fifth Republic. Everything depends so much on Macron. You know, it could be that he'll simply have too much to do and disappoint the greater aspirations as the long five-year term draws on. But I don't think so. I'm still quite a Macronite.
But I think, yeah, one of the dangers could be also a certain arrogance or hubris,
yeah,
like self-confidence that will make him lose sight of some basic social problems, for
which
example.
Which there were signs of in the early years, but he seems to have I'm going to be seen like a fawning Macronite here, but he seems intelligent enough to realise his own failings and weaknesses and put them right. Now, that may not go on. We will see.
Well, meanwhile, we have a president waiting by the phone wanting to know where they're going to go on their second date in their bromance, I think. Anyway, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Florence Biederman and Jonathan Fenby. Coming up next, the tricky task of moving Britain's parliament to make way for long overdue renovations. Stay tuned.
The First Monocle of 2018 is a media special, which takes us into the parallel worlds of music, movies, TV, technology, and, of course, print. We sit down with Takeshi Idezawa, the CEO of Japanese messaging app LINE, and get to know the cast of oddball characters who have helped him and his company conquer Asia. We head to LA for an expo that goes behind the scenes at the studios producing that most enduring and best-loved format in American television, the game show. From The Price is Right to Wheel of Fortune, we discover what lies behind the undying popularity of such programmes. Then it's off to Indonesia to meet the team that publishes Compass, the leading Catholic-owned newspaper in a country where over 85% of the population is Muslim. And finally, in the design section, we take a tour around the former Berlin Broadcasting House that's been converted into a slick new arts hub. The Monocle February issue is out now. Get your media fix and pick up your copy today, or subscribe at monocle.com.
This is Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck, and still with me are Jonathan Fenby and Florence Biederman. There's little debate around the desperate need for renovations at Westminster. The home of Britain's Parliament is in a state of disrepair, with 24-hour fire patrols needed to guard against potential disasters. But the question of where to relocate, or even if to relocate, is still something that's causing a lot of controversy. Jonathan, I'll come to you as the Brit around the table first of all. Let's get the simple question out. So the place is falling to pieces, as everyone knows, and the potential bill is billions. And we also know in the UK, when you add these sums up, they're never correct. So it's more than whatever they've said it's going to be. And it could take years and years. So some people say, get the whole lot of them out there, move them to another building for six, seven years. Other people say, do it piecemeal. What do you think is the right process?
I think you have to do it at one fell swoop, as it were. If you start to move, you know, bits of Parliament out and other bits are left behind, you'll have enormous confusion about who should be where, basically, not just the debating chambers of the Commons and the Lords, but also all the committee rooms and everything else, which are hard enough to find, as it is very often. The problem is, where could you move to? Of course, some people would like Parliament to move entirely outside London to reduce the preponderance of London in British life. Or maybe Parliament should move around between England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, which would probably be the worst idea of all. You know, you can see them being stuck on a train somewhere in the middle of the Midlands on a stormy Sunday night. It wouldn't be a very good idea. Maybe the best place would be just up Whitehall, the great banqueting hall there at Whitehall, with its tremendous Charles I era the ceiling there, which is a wonderful place, at least for, as a debating chamber it could be. And of course, just outside was the place where Charles I had his head cut off. So it would be a kind of reminder of the supremacy of Parliament.
Florence, one of the reasons many MPs, especially a few diehard Tories, don't want to move because they feel that all the kind of the surroundings feed into our politics in a way that, you know, how the discourse happens, how the ways our laws are framed, the building has some impact. And maybe from what you've been saying about France and its modernity, that we should try and jump ahead by moving to a very contemporary building. You know, you deal with politicians here and you know Parliament, but how much do you think Britain is reflected in that building, or do you think that politics is not shaped by the Parliament it's in?
Well, it's part of it. I mean, it's part of the history. It's part of the psyche. And by the way, I mean, it's difficult to move for everybody, you know, in everybody's life. I mean, this is considered as one of the difficult things to do. So that people resist moving, there will always be people, whatever the situation is. But, okay, you're talking about modernism, and that's my regret, that my favorite project was ruled out, like it was kind of a giant bubble, a floating parliament that would have been just close to the building that has been suggested by an architecture firm, Gensler, but it was not accepted.
Well, maybe we could see if the Elysee Palace has got any space that they could rent us for a few years, and so we could pick up a few modern tips, and our MPs could learn a second language as well, which wouldn't be bad. Finally tonight, the IKEA effect, as it's casually known, is a phenomenon in which we tend to attach more value to objects which we have had a hand in building. For some of us, that object might be a Billy bookcase. But for Ingvar Kamprad, it was the world's largest furniture retailer, IKEA. He passed away at the weekend at the age of 91, leaving behind a complex legacy of flat-pack masterpieces, extreme frugalities, an aversion to waste, and a wartime flirtation with fascism. Jonathan, what do you make of the IKEA story? Because there are very few brands or businesses that have that much of an impact on your life. And I think at the end of it, we're not quite sure whether we like the impact or not.
Well, of course, you could relate it back to the previous topic and say we should have a flat pack parliament just to put up somewhere on some bit of empty ground. Well, I'm absolutely one of those people who, at a certain stage in my life, actually when we were living in Germany, in Bonn, we used to go off to the IKEA store, actually mainly to eat the gravlax and the meatballs rather than anything. But one would always come back with a bit of flat pack furniture, which I would then find it impossible to put together. My wife has a long joke, which I won't go into now, about putting up IKEA furniture, which reduces her to helpless laughter the whole time. So it lives on in that sense in our life. But I saw in one of the obituaries of the founder that it is calculated, I'm not sure by whom or on what basis, that 10% of the population of Europe was conceived in an IKEA bed. And that's quite something to think about.
I was also told that apart from the Bible, there were certain points where the only book that was more, the only other printed material that was so popular was the catalogue. Yeah. Florence, what do you make of the impact of this extraordinary brand on our life and what this man did to our sensibilities and our taste? Because in a way, he created an easy way for people to have simple, modest style in their homes, but he created a world of the disposable that has fed in many senses. You know, and we must point out, this is a brand that's trying to correct that in many ways, but they are part of this world of disposable furniture almost.
Yeah, disposable, and also the furniture that you will find everywhere, so which means the personality of the owner is not really put into this. No, I'm struck by what Jonathan said. I have also been in the IKEA in Bonn for the same reason years ago, which means it's
maybe
not...
Maybe your trolleys bumped into each other.
It's not only like the Billy cardboard or whatever, but it's an experience in daily life. I mean, it's something that you cannot do without when you don't have too much money and you want to buy some furniture also. So it's part of our life. So you can criticize, yes, the fact that it's disposable, that it has no special character, etc., but it's still like, well, the easy and cheap way to have decent furniture. So
it's very easy to be snobbish, I think, about IKEA and so on. But it did serve definitely a purpose. And of course, my IKEA story is that we bought a dining table, and in the middle of a dinner party, the middle bit fell out.
And those you presents didn't still assemble it in the right way.
I was not made for that. I go out and buy a proper table.
Well done. Well, I think we've all had our experiences there. And there was a point where nobody didn't have like tea lights and things in their house. Everyone was buying them by the hundreds from their stores.
Well, there'll be a revival, perhaps.
I'm sure. But that brings us to the end of our Flat Pack show today. Florence Biederman and Jonathan Fenby, thanks very much for helping put it all together here on Midori House. Today's show was produced by Ben Rylan. It was researched by Gaia Lutz and also by Stephanie Sikia. And our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next, then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show with Mr. Robert Bound. And we're going to have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily, which is, of course, at 2200 hours here in London. Midori House is going to be back at the very same time tomorrow, and that's at 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and have a great day. Bye-bye.